Carl Thornton Jr. Good to have you all on another Power Friday, where it is time for us to receive some political insights with Assistant Professor of Political Science at the Augusta University, Dr. Craig Albert. Dr. Albert, good to have you aboard again. How you doing?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. And of course, as we all know, there has been a whole lot going on in the world of political science and in the world of politics across the nation and around the world. And fortunately, I was sharing with you a little bit earlier that on this program, one of the things that I share with the listening community is that I really like building community on the local, state, national, and international levels. And very often when we're talking about community on the international level, it really is still community because we're sharing with people in America how decisions made here affect folks across the seas and vice versa. And so I'm glad that you're here to shed some light on some things that we've been reading about, hearing about in the news. And I think that it's time for us to really go about the business of just getting a better grasp on some of these topics we've been hearing about. And it has to do with the country that we call Kurdistan. If you could just lay the foundation by refreshing our memory, reminding us of what is happening with Kurdistan, what is generally the activity surrounding that country?
So Kurdistan is, it's not technically a country, it's a nation. So it's the largest nation without its own defined country. So the area of Kurdistan goes between four different countries, which is Iraq, northern Iraq, Syria, Iran, and Turkey. And so little swaths of each parts of those lands are what the Kurds call Kurdistan.
Interesting.
Political scientists and most of the international community recognize it as Kurdistan as being a distinct autonomous group. They have an autonomous government, part of the federal structure of Iraq. But even in Iran, Syria, and Turkey, the land extends into their territories. And that's what a lot of the conflict and issues are with it, with Turkey, with Syria. With all the battles that they're fighting against terrorism, the Kurds come in to play a part as well. And especially against ISIS, the Kurds have been one of the main fighting forces, the main fighting force in northern Iraq against ISIS. The Iraqi National Army actually fled most of the campaigns against ISIS when ISIS was first taking over and controlling areas, especially in Mosul and other areas in northern Iraq. Large oil-producing areas from Iraq, they fled because they weren't expecting, they weren't prepared to fight ISIS. And that's the traditional Kurdish territory. So the Kurdish militia, it's called the Peshmerga, which I think loosely translated means those who are ready to die, combated and kept those cities safe or took those cities back. And so now they're against ISIS. So you probably remember on the news a few years ago, the Yazidis that were an ethnic group that were trapped on Mount Sinjar in Iraq, and there was a lot of humanitarian outcry mm-hmm. about how to get these folks because there were thousands of them, and ISIS had surrounded the mountain and were just killing anybody that was of the Yazidi group because ISIS, a fanatical group that has fanatical Islamic beliefs. So if you don't believe specifically what they believe about Islam and how you should use it, you don't deserve to live if you don't believe what ISIS believes. And so they would kill any groups that they determined to be less than them within Islam. And that includes the Kurds. And the Yazidis are a subgroup of the Kurds, a little bit different traditional clan-based than the Kurds are themselves, but still a part of the Kurd ethnicity. They're an ethnic group. So they're tied together. The Kurds, all the Kurds, are tied together with what they say are distinct bloodlines, traditional ancestral connections between the different clans and ties, common language, common religion that separate them from everybody around them. So they identify with common traits that are a little different from other groups in the area. And for Iraq, the main distinguishing groups would be the Shia and Sunni. So the Kurds are distinct in all of those areas from the Sunni and Shia. And ISIS is mainly a Sunni organization, so that's how they define themselves, and so they set themselves up against Kurds. And some of the main fights that have occurred, especially in northern Iraq, were between those two elements. And then the Kurds followed them into Syria, ISIS in Syria, and you have this, and they teamed up with the Syrian Kurds, a little bit different than the Iraqi Kurds, still same bloodlines, but they have different traditions based on how the government they lived within has allowed them to settle and allowed them to live in each of these different countries. They're always persecuted no matter where they are, whether it's Turkey. Turkey's designated the Kurds as a terrorist organization, specifically the PKK and the Kurdistan People's Workers Party in Turkey. And they do fight the Turkish government with some acts of terrorism. But they're separate from the main Iraqi element of the Kurds, which are separate from the main Syrian element of the Kurds. So they're very distinctly or loosely tied together by bloodlines, but that each country has a little different understanding of how they operate. So they're a loose affiliation with no formal country that recognizes them. But without the Kurds, this is why I think Americans need to understand them a little more. And this is part of the reason we went to Iraq in 2003 was because how Saddam treated the Kurds. And one of the reasons we established a no-fly zone in the first Gulf War is to protect the Kurds from Saddam Hussein's retaliation against them for helping us expel him from Kuwait. And their role with the Iranian-Iraqi War. I mean, they're just all involved with this. But without their assistance, ISIS would not have been beaten back in Iraq, and they'd still hold 90% of all of northern Iraq right now. So they have been the main fighting force in most of those large areas in the north and in Syria, pushing them back. They're one of the main groups fighting ISIS, fighting Al-Qaeda as well in Syria, are these Kurds. So they are really, the unsung heroes of this conflict.
You mentioned the fact that ISIS is a radical extremist element of Islam, and the fact that they read the Quran and they take out those parts of it that say, hey, look, war is justified according to our religion. And if there's anyone who does not support our cause, even if they are fellow Muslims, they're not worth being considered called Muslims, and we'll kill them just as readily as we'll kill someone who's not a Muslim who is against our cause. I'm saying that to ask this. Help us get a firmer grasp on how or why, whichever word you prefer to use, ISIS even came into existence in the first place.
ISIS was a part of Al-Qaeda in Iraq in the late 1990s and early 2000s. And they were the way Al-Qaeda worked after 9/11 is that it became a decentralized terrorist organization. So in other words, it had networks in lots of different countries, lots of different areas, but they were cut off from each other on purpose so that the United States couldn't infiltrate one cell and know everything that was going on worldwide. Mm-hmm. It was a little more centralized than that, controlled by bin Laden, of course, before 9/11, but then after 9/11, in order for it to survive, it had to kind of allow it to be kind of a confederation, like an alignment, a movement of different unaffiliated groups that kind of got funneled some money from bin Laden, or what we call Al-Qaeda Central. When bin Laden was dead, Zarahari, the leader of Al-Qaeda still today, kind of direct those individuals very loosely when they can. He'll release, radio segments or propaganda, enticing them to attack different areas of the world, but no direct communications or anything so that we can't knock all of them out if we find one. And Iraq started becoming decentralized with the Al-Qaeda movement there. And some groups started to get upset that they weren't engaging in worse terrorist acts than what bin Laden at the time was allowing around 2004, 2005. So they started to separate themselves. Al-Qaeda in Iraq started to separate itself from Al-Qaeda Central. And eventually they separated themselves so much that in about 2012, they created ISIS. So ISIS, most people should be terrified at this fact. ISIS is a more radical form of terrorism than Al-Qaeda.
Interesting.
So Al-Qaeda, in fact, at the height of ISIS territory control in Syria and Iraq, late 2014, 2015, Al-Qaeda told ISIS to calm it down. They're like, whoa, y'all are pretty brutal. Let's calm this down. That's not how you should be doing. And they kind of fought a civil war for a while between each other. They have different theological understandings. Both of those movements are based on their understanding of apocalyptic theology, apocalyptic Islamic theology. both of them include the apocalyptic, wow, that's a hard word to say three times in a row. Both of them include all monotheistic understandings of the end of the world within their interpretation. Of course, Islam includes the Judeo-Christian traditions within its holy book as well, just slightly different understandings of the role of Christ, for instance, whether he's a prophet or if he's son of God and God at the same time.
And interestingly enough, while you're on that, there are radical extremist Muslims who do teach that towards the end of the Great Tribulation, Jesus is actually going to return.
Yeah, I believe this is, now hopefully if I'm wrong, someone will forgive me and nicely let me know so I can correct myself. Because I only study Islam as it relates to my study of terrorism. Mm-hmm. And so I obviously don't study all of Islam. I just study the part that is relevant to terrorists, or how they use it, or they say it's relevant to them. But from what I understand, for all of Islam, the when one dies, one is greeted by Jesus and says, Jesus says, okay, they kind of give you one more chance, one more understanding to accept the Muslim tradition. You know, Allah is God. You know, I'm the prophet leading to Muhammad, but he's the last prophet, and I'm here to usher you through one more chance. You know, that's how I understand it. I could be wrong. I apologize if I am. But
yeah, it's interesting because on the one hand, there's some of them who say that Jesus is going to come back. He's going to kind of help reestablish peace on the earth. But they also teach that the prophet Muhammad is also going to return. And he's going to play a greater role in establishing order than Jesus will. So it's a very, very complex, and the reason I bring that up, very, very complex religion. And when you think about, you know, we're talking about, and ladies and gentlemen, please hear us, when we say, I think we kind of emphasize this, the radical extremist Muslims are the ones who say war justifies any political religious means. But many, many, as you were saying, they will, the radical extremists will kill other Muslims if they don't agree with their religious philosophies about this. And of course, a lot of those Muslims who they deem unworthy are those who say that is not the Quran teaches. The Quran does not teach unjustified war just because you have some political ends or some religious ends. That is not justified. That is not what the Quran teaches. And that's where, just like Christians, sometimes fall out over what the Bible says. You sometimes have Muslims who fall out over what the Quran says.
Yeah, and ISIS and Al-Qaeda are great at recruiting people that aren't traditionally involved in mosque life. They're not traditional practice, or, you know, and I'm Catholic, so in Catholicism we call those like cafeteria Catholics.
Okay.
So what ISIS and Al-Qaeda does is try to attract you know, cultural Muslims or cafeteria Muslims that aren't really, you know, they don't really know their faith, they don't really know their religion, they're isolated, they're alienated, they feel oppressed somehow by the regime they're living in, but they still haven't turned to religion because they're just not that religious. Well, these radical Islamic groups find them out and then recruit them into their cause, first by offering them friendship before they get into the specifics of their theology. Then, you know, maybe they give them a job and they start working and getting money through them. Well, now they're, you know, considered family. So their friends, their employment's with them, their family. And then they say, hey, you know, this is our religion. And they teach them specifically the extremist aspects of everything. And that's how they recruit people. That's how they recruit them online. ISIS has a formidable, what we call digital caliphate, that they attract individuals from worldwide.
It is so interesting that you have organizations, whether it be radical Muslims or skinheads, who use some of the same tactics in recruiting.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, look for the one who feels like an outcast, like the world's against them, and has dealt them a bad hand. They feel down and out anyway. They feel like they're alone in the world. Like you say, hey, we'll be your family.
You know, what's interesting is my students often ask, Dr. Albert, how can we stop terrorism? Like, well, we can love everybody. Like, what do you mean? I'm like, if people don't feel isolated, they don't feel alienated, a lot of these acts of terror wouldn't occur because they wouldn't be able to be recruited. Same with like school shootings and these horrible tragedies. You know, I often tell my students the way you can change the world isn't necessarily at the micro level. It's just when you see, you know, when you get a grumpy cashier or you're a cashier and you get a grumpy customer, turn it around and like be nice to them, you know, give them some love, you know, as much as you can. Like, don't, you know, don't get hurt by them. Don't let them take advantage by you. But, you know, throw some love their way and you never know what kind of difference that makes.
Ladies and gentlemen, we got to keep that in mind. As a matter of fact, throughout the rest of this conversation, if you would, at least consider keeping love at the forefront of our minds. We'll be right back.